Good morning.
Good morning.
Oh, I'm from Texas, and we speak in Texas. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm so selfish and self-centered. My name is Lewis, and I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict.
Hey, Lewis.
And I'd like to express my appreciation to the Randy and Arthur and the committee for inviting me. I'd like to say thank you for the wonderful fruit basket. I usually kind of get to going and forget about all of that. And I'd like to introduce you to my wife. Earlene, would you stand up, please? You know, this program really works. Saturday, we'll celebrate our 35th wedding anniversary, you know. We haven't been married that long. But everybody states that the 35th is so wonderful, we thought maybe we'd just celebrate it, you know. We have been married 31 years, though. And it's so nice to be here. I was doing all right. I wasn't nervous or anything. And then Earlene said, "Are you nervous?" And hell, I've been nervous ever since. You know? I'll get going in a minute. I suffer from a lot of prejudice. My name is Lewis, and do y'all remember that picture of the nerds? You know, the head nerd's name was what? Lewis, you know. All real men from Texas are over 6'5", and I'm 5'2", you know. I'm a doctor, and a lot of alcoholics don't like doctors, you know. I'm a psychiatrist, and all alcoholics hate psychiatrists, you know. And I'm a specialist in alcohol and drug dependency, you know. You know, so I don't have a shot at this thing, you know. We just developed this specialty about 3 years ago, a specialist in alcohol and drugs. And I think the reason we developed it, we found out there's a lot of bread to be made treating us, you know. All these counselors was making this money, you know. You know, we got to get this thing in perspective. We had to take an all-day test. And, you know, there were no schools where, you know, you could go and take a course. So what you had to do, you had to go all over the country. And I've been everywhere from Hawaii on the weekends to all over to Canada studying for this test. I'm really so grateful and so proud because 99.9% of the things they taught us, I had already learned right here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I think we ought to, you know. But there's one thing I learned that I had not known from AA. And if I teach this to you, then you will certify and be qualified to sit for the test. And they taught us the difference between a social drinker, an alcohol abuser, and an alcohol dependent or a real alcoholic. And it's called the two martini test. Guy goes into a bar, social drink, and he orders a martini. And the bartender brings, and there's a fly in it. The social drinker says, "Bartender, there's a fly in my martini." And the bartender said, "Oh, sir, I'll bring you another one." And the social drinker sits there just as nice, and he brings him another, and he drinks it down. Now, the alcohol abuser goes into the bar, and he orders a martini, and there's two flies in it. He says, "Sir, there's two flies in my martini." And the bartender says, "Oh, sir, that's all right. I'll bring you another one." And while the bartender's gone, the alcohol, you know, abuser will take the flies out, you know, and throw them away and then drink the martini. Now, a real alcoholic, he goes into the bar and he orders a martini. The bartender brings, there's two flies in it. The real alcoholic jumps up and says, "God damn it, there's two flies in my martini." And the bartender says, "Sir, I'll bring you another one." Now, while the bartender has gone, the real alcoholic will take the two flies out of the martini and squeeze all of the alcohol back in it, you know, and finish the drink. Now, you have certified to be one of us. Well, I was born in Wagner, Oklahoma in 1938, My mom and dad already had six kids they couldn't take care of. They had left with my grandmother in Wagner. They had gone to Joplin, Missouri to work. But a lot of times when you're born unexpected, you kind of get everything. When I was born, Mom went to Wagner, left me, and I had six sisters and a grandmother, and they all had, Scotty say last night, black belts in Al-Anon. Ladies and gentlemen, you're looking at a person that's been taken care of all my life. I've never had to want for anything. I've never had to work. I've never even had a fight in my whole life. When I got married, my mother built another room on the house and moved my wife in. Earlene and I would get to arguing back there, and one of my sisters would just come back and straighten that shit out. You know. I've never had anything. The only job I've ever had to have in life was to make my grandmother know that she needed me. I've never spent a night away from home because I pee in the bed. You're talking about a boy born with a silver spoon in his mouth. Now, don't misunderstand me. Wagner, Oklahoma, 1938, nobody had nothing, but we had more of nothing than anybody else, so we were kind of uppity, you know? My grandmother was kind of the matriarch of the community because she had a cow and three hogs, and she had 2 acres of vegetables, so, you know, we passed stuff out, and we kind of got to be the uppity people in the community. You know, Mama taught me early in life, dears can't drink. All my uncles on my father's died of alcoholism. All my uncles on my mother's side died of alcoholism. I think my aunts died on both sides died of alcoholism, too, but women didn't have alcoholism. They had consumption. You know, and so everybody in the... And Mama taught me, you know, Mama taught me that, you know, we dears can't drink, son, and you can't drink. And I made a vow to Mama that I'd never drink. Now, my high school principal, later on, I got to be confidential, so I was his chauffeur, and he was an alcoholic and drug addict, died of an overdose of alcohol and Seconal at the age of 46, and I was his chauffeur, and I made a vow to him I'd never drink, and I was a big-time Christian until I was about 16 or 17. I made a vow to God that I would never drink. You know? So I was reared with that bad attitude concerning alcohol. I hated alcohol. I've hated everything about alcohol all of my life. You know, went to school when I was 6, you know, feeling different. People have done everything for me all my life, and I've always felt different. You know, I've always been lonely. I've always been alone. I've never felt as if I were a part of, always apart from. I've never been in there. I've always kind of on the outside looking in, you know. At 6, I had to go to school. And for the first time in my life, I had to be a regular kid, you know, because there were 23 other little prince and princesses in the first grade. You know, and I went in there, and they were all talking at the same time, kind of like an AA meeting, you know. And they were pushing each other, and it scared me to death. I didn't have nobody to take up for me. And I went and I hid under the teacher's desk. And, of course, when classes started, I had to come out from under the desk, and the only seat left in the class was on the front row next to a girl named Fern. Fern was fine. I had to have Fern before 5 o'clock that evening. I mean, Fern was fabulous. You know, in time I looked at Fern, I knew exactly what kind of doctor I wanted to be. I wanted to be a gynecologist, you know. Now the hot thing to do in Wagner, Oklahoma in 1944 was to eat your peanut butter and jelly sandwich with your chicken in the lunchroom. But I had a major problem. I wanted to eat my sandwich with Fern, but I had a major problem. I was scared to talk to Fern. See, I had fear of rejection before I knew what fear of rejection was, you know. And I just had all these fears. My first day of school, I had all of the problems that we alcoholics talk about. I had a problem with resentment because we had a boy in the class named Linwood. Now, Linwood never walked. Linwood was born strolling, you know. He was the class pimp, I call him. Now, he was a music teacher's son. You know, I can remember him strolling up to Fern and asking her to eat his peanut butter and jelly sandwich with her in the lunchroom. And I can remember her saying yes, and I can remember them walking by me going on to the lunchroom. And I can remember grinning, but I can remember the feelings I had on the inside. I wanted them to go into the lunchroom and sit down, get there, start eating, and then I was going to burn the lunchroom down, you know? You know, I wanted to go out and rip up their bicycle tires. You know, I'm this grinning, cute kid on the outside, but deep down on the inside all my life, I've been just evil and deceitful and just wanting to kill and punish anything and everybody. But on the outside, I was Miss Allbirdie's good little boy, you know? had a problem with fear. Never had a fight. One day, Bobby Joe and I were out in the yard playing. And Bobby Joe and I started fighting. And of course, I started running. And I was winning. I ran past my dad. And my father said, called me over after we got through. And my dad said, "What were you doing?" And I said, "Well, Bobby Joe and I were having a race. And I was winning, you know." I should have been a lawyer. I can think on my feet, you know. And my dad said, "No, you're lying. Y'all were fighting. And you were running. You're a coward." And he said, "Deers don't run. We stand up and kick butt." You know, I compared myself to this deer, and I've been a coward all my life, and I come up short. I always had a problem with sex. Asked my mother about it, and she told me, "Don't do it." Asked my grandmother, and she said, "Don't shine your shoes too bright and stand too close to your sisters when they're wearing dresses." I don't know what she's talking about, you know. Asked my principal, and he named all the parts and made me intellectually ignorant. But all was not lost, because I had a guru. And his name was Leroy. You know. Now, Leroy had three disciples, Alvin, Otis, and me. Now, Leroy was 15, Otis was 13, Alvin was 12, and I was 10 or 11. But everywhere you'd see Leroy, you'd see Alvin, Otis, and me. And Leroy would give us these lectures about sex. And Leroy described the real man. And when Leroy would say a real man, his voice would get deep. You know, and Leroy taught us what a real man was one day. He said that a real man had a performance time of anywhere from 20 minutes to 2 hours and 20 minutes. You know, he said that a real man could make all the girls holler. He said that a real man had at least 3 illegitimate children by the time he was 18. He said that a real man had an appendage at least 10 inches long. You know, and he said that a real man, you know, every woman he touched, he got her pregnant, whether she'd had a hysterectomy or not. You know. And I compared myself to Leroy's real man, and I came up short in all departments. You know, ladies and gentlemen, when I went to college, I weighed 95 pounds. And there was, you know, and you had to have 6 hours of physical education, and there was no way I was going to take my clothes off in front of those jocks. So I got a job passing out towels in the locker room, you know. And I guess I said that to let you know that I've seen over 17,000 boys and men naked, and guess what? None of them compare to Leroy's man, you know. But I believed Leroy until I was 46 years of age, you know. You know, when I say it's kind of funny, but, you know, I'm a kid, and we kids believe the first story. So tell your children, you know, the right way. And if you don't have enough courage, take them to a psychiatrist and pay him that $125, and, you know, so they'll tell it, you know. Well, anyhow, things went on. I didn't drink, and I was this super nice guy, and I was just Mr. Wonderful. But I didn't have any friends my age because I always was different. I was always strange. You know, and I never had any opportunity. I ran around with the high school principal. I was their runner to the bootleg place. And I was just Mr. Wonderful. I drove his car all the time. And then it came the night of the senior prom, and Earlene and I went together, the same lady I'm married to today. And I walked in, I couldn't dance, couldn't sing, you know, I couldn't do any of those things because I never ran around with kids my age. You know, and the boys didn't like me because they thought they were better than me, and I didn't speak to them, and they thought that I thought I was better than them, and they didn't speak to me. You know, and so I went in, and then, you know, and I couldn't dance, couldn't sing, and then the band began to play. And terror struck my heart because I couldn't dance, and Earlene liked to dance. And some little boy come up and ask Earlene to dance, and those thoughts came back. They're screwing over me again. 600 people in this auditorium, and he came and asked my girl to dance, and she went to dance with him. And as usual, I headed for the restroom. And when I got to the restroom, you know, I opened the door. And in Wagner, Oklahoma in 1956, see, things were different. They're not like they are now. We didn't have any crack and cocaine and weed and sesamelia and Maui Wowie and Thai sticks, and the only thing we got off on was homemade whiskey and, I mean homemade beer and White Lightning. And the boys were sneaking in a half a gallon of homemade beer. We call it chalk in Oklahoma. How many of y'all ever heard of chalk? God, there's a bunch of Christians here, you know. You know, anyhow, we were sneaking in this chalk, and they said, "Hey, Tuffy, why don't you be regular and have a drink with us?" Tuffy's my nickname because I'm such a cream puff. You know, and the only reason they offered me a drink was I was a school narc, and they knew that if I didn't drink, I was going to tell. So I took, you know, and I had this vow to Mama that I'd never drink. I had a vow to God I'd never drink. And I had a vow to my high school principal I'd never drink. But a voice deep down on the inside of me said, "Sure, fellas." You know, and I took this cup of chop, you know, and it was lukewarm. And I headed to my mouth with it, and I made a major mistake because time I got to my mouth, I took a deep breath. And ladies and gentlemen, chalk is the worst smelling stuff in life. You know, how many of y'all ever smelled any chalk? Let me see you. Pretty good. How many of y'all ever smelled a hog pen? All right. You know, chalk smells like hog food once it's been through the hog. I mean, it is terrible, you know. But I'm an alcoholic without having a drink because I slammed it on down. And as a friend of mine at home called David A. Stay, as he went down, it just relaxed me rib by rib by rib. And I got that perpetual grin on my face again. And normally I went out for drink number two. Had two drinks, life was fun. All of a sudden, I was grinning. I was dancing. I was dancing. I was singing. See, ladies and gentlemen, God has been so good to me that I can do just about a little of any and everything. But you see, if I can't be the best, I'll say I can't do that, and I'll go over in the corner and talk about anyone who tries to do it, you know? The boy said, "Tuffy, you're really not a stuck-up SOB like we thought you were. Man, you're all right." You know, ladies and gentlemen, alcohol made me appear. Alcohol is powerful stuff in my life. It made me one of the fellas for the first time in my life. You know, I had a good time. Earlene said, "That's the first time I've ever acted normal over 4 hours in my entire life, including today." You know? Said I didn't try to rape her. But I woke up the next morning, and all the other boys were down on the street corner talking about who wrecked whose car, who's in the hospital, who's dead, you know, who's in jail, who's so-and-so and so-and-so. And when I got out of bed, I felt good, had the best night's sleep I ever had in my life, and I got down on my knees and I began to pray, "Oh God, if you don't let Mama find out, I'll never do it again. If you don't let the high school principal find out, I'll never do it again." That lasted for 2 weeks until we went to the senior picnic and Earlene started square dancing with someone. And I didn't wait until the boys with the booze found me. I went and I found them. And I had more than one drink, two drinks this time. I got drunk. You know, I started to fight between two other people, and I threw up on Earlene's new dress. And that's my whole drunkalogue. I could talk from now on, but that was what I would have to say, because from then on, every time I drank, I got drunk, started trouble, and threw up, you know, and got sick, you know. Somehow I lucked out of high school, because I kind of intuitively knew that if I began to drink, I couldn't stop. So I never drank until I'd done all my study and all my work. Went to college, lucked out of there. Went to med school, lucked out of there, and came back to Dallas to work with a guy. And I drank that up in 11 months. And I remember cursing him out in the middle of the Dallas County Courthouse. I told him, "I'll show you, you SOB. I'll quit drinking and I'll get rich. I don't need you." You see, he had asked me one day. He said, "Lewis, some of the patients are saying that you smell like booze when you come in. And your eyes are red and you're kind of mean to them now." You know, and the man just loved me. You know, he just loved me. I had an opportunity to be his sponsor 3 years later, you know. But the man loved me. See, and the reason the man loved me so much, I doubled his practice. I was an excellent doctor when I was drinking. I mean, I was a good doctor when I was drinking now. You know, because I kept it simple. You know, patients would come in. I'd say, "How are you doing?" They'd say, "Just fine." I'd say, "What's your problem?" They'd say, "Well, doctor, I have this back pain." And I'd say, "Well, have you ever had anything like this before?" And they'd say, "Yes." I said, "Well, did you go to the doctor?" "Well, yes, I did, doctor." I said, "Well, what did the doctor give you?" "Tylenol number 3. And I said, "Uh-huh, that's the problem. You need Tylenol number 4. And they just loved me. You know, I passed out the dope. I wrote all kind of Valium prescriptions, and the patients just loved. The old ladies would bring me cakes and pies on the weekend. You know, and they just loved me. You know, but anyhow, he accused me of that without thinking. I cursed him out. I talked about his parents, and I stole all the charts. He took all the money, and 30 days later, we met down in the middle of the Dallas County Courthouse. I told him, "I'll show you, I'll quit drinking and I'll get rich." How many of y'all are kind of like I am? You know, you're so brilliant and so intelligent that you know the answers to all questions, but my problem is I have trouble putting the questions with the right answers. You know, I knew the answers, I just didn't know how to match the questions with the answers. Well, anyhow, ladies and gentlemen, it was one of those drunk vows, and I kept it for 26 months. I didn't drink for that long. And ladies and gentlemen, every day I woke up with a vow I won't drink. But I'd work 18, 20 hours a day. I did everything possible that it was to make a dollar except fall in love with another man. You know, if you got something so bad that you need somebody so good to listen, call on me. Because I've done it all at 26 months to make that money. At the end of that 26 months, you know how we alcoholics are. If we promise you something, we'll do it. You know, and at the end of that 26 months, I had that figure on a financial statement that said I was wealthy. And I decided to go to Detroit, Michigan and learn how to treat methadone addicts. You know, and it was a Sunday, and I had a brand new Cadillac. I made my secretary go get me a briefcase, and I had to have my initials on it. Of course, you know, I went first class, and I can remember sitting on, it was TWA, and I can remember sitting on that jet and first class and had that grin on my face, and I had my secretary come to the door and say, "Goodbye, Dr. Dear." I love to hear my name called at that time. You know, and she had to buckle me in, and you know, in 1974, life was wonderful. You know, the ladies were wearing micro minis, and the tube tops were tight and cut deep, and it was just an old voyeur's delight that year. And, and women were really women then. You know, the stewardess, when they'd come by, they'd get down on their knees, and they'd look up at you, and they'd lick their lips, and "Dr. Dear, what would you like to drink?" And a voice deep down on the inside of me said, "A double Johnny Walker Black and water." You know, 26 months, ladies and gentlemen, I hadn't had a drink. But the book is right. At certain times, we have no defense against that first drink. Now, I didn't bring it right then. In Dallas at that time, you couldn't get a drink in Texas. You had to wait till we got out of Texas airspace. It was 45 minutes you brought the drink. I drank that one, drank another. And on drink number six, the idea came to me, "Boy, you're not supposed to be drinking." Another idea came to hell with that control stuff today. I'll start on it tomorrow. I'm going to get good and drunk today. Well, it took me 3 weeks to sober up to get to the school, you know. I got to the school, it was a joke. They were having riots in Detroit. And, you know, it was really a joke. There's about 18 of us doctors from the United States and Canada. We were treating about 4,000 methadone addicts a day in a big old movie theater. And the treatment consisted of this. We'd give 400 their methadone, and we'd put one on stage and wouldn't give him his methadone. And we'd make him tell his story to the other 400, and we called that therapy. And all 18 of us doctors would sit in the back drinking martinis and talking about those dirty old drug addicts, you know? You know. Now, we stayed in the middle of the Detroit River in two yachts because we were too good to, you know, to come in town to the riots. You know, and every night, at least one of us, and most nights, two of us would fall off the boat from being drunk. In time, we'd get back on and we'd talk about those dirty old drug addicts, you know. I weighed about 245 pounds then, and I had trouble walking from the boat to get up to the plank, to get up to the car, to go to the center. And I'd just be huffing and puffing and huffing and puffing. One day, a doctor from Canada, you know, one of those freaky dudes, you know, he was dressed perfect every day. He had that smile on his face. His weight was perfect. How many of y'all know Robert Shuler? How many of y'all ever seen Robert Shuler? You know, he looked just like Robert Shuler. And on Monday morning, he would tell you things like, "Good morning." You know, you just want to throw up in his face. You know, I'm walking up the plank one day, and he's walking behind me. He said, "Boy, you are in bad shape." He said, "How do you do those things your wife wants you to do?" And I said, very sparingly. And he said, "When we get to the center, I'm going to take your blood pressure. If it's all right, I'm going to give you some pills because I used to be overweight like you." And he took my pressure, and it was cool, and he gave me some pills. He said, "Now, Lewis, this will take away your appetite for 15 to 17 hours. Take them early in the morning. If you don't, it might make you nervous." And I said, "All right." I knew the damn things wouldn't work, of course. So he gave me some black mollies, you know. And I took them. He gave me seven. I took the mollies. He said, "Take them right." I woke up at 6 that morning. I took a black molly. And guess what happened? I went right back to sleep, you know. But at 7 o'clock, it hit me. And I've been smiling like this ever since. You know? You know? How many of y'all remember your first rush from a molly? Yeah. Oh, it's wonderful, you know. You know, all of a sudden you acquire all of this knowledge. You know, you know everything. You know, I was on the phone talking to my secretary, telling her how to run the office. I was on the other phone telling Earlene how to run the house. And I was telling some guy, "You can't wear white socks with a brown suit, fool." I was just running the universe. You know, to me, my first hit of speed was like running 50 miles an hour with your feet nailed to the floor. You know, I mean, it was just wonderful. You know, and being an alcoholic, I took another black molly. You know, did real good the first week. I lost 7 pounds. Came back for a little more drugs. Said, how you doing, Lewis? Said, everything's fine. He said, are you sure? I said, every once in a while, I get a little nervous. He said, Lewis, I know what you're talking about. I had that problem, too. He said, I took a little Valium. He said, Lewis, don't take but 10 milligrams. Well, if you tell me to take 10 milligrams, I got to take what? 20, you know? So now I did real fine the next 2 weeks. Lost another 14 pounds. My pants were getting loose. And when I get around the young girls, I had a tendency to pull my pants up and adjust them. And I came back for a little more drugs the next 2 weeks. Said, Lewis, how you doing? I said, everything's fine. He said, are you sure? And he said, are you sure, Lewis? I said, well, every now and then, every once in a while, I have a little trouble sleeping. He said, Lewis, I know what you're talking about. I had that problem too. He said, and what I did, I took a little Seconal, a little Reds. And he said, Lewis, don't take but one. Do you remember Marilyn Monroe? I said, yes. How could you forget her? He said, Lewis, this is what killed her, an overdose of Seconal and alcohol. And so now, ladies and gentlemen, my life is lived totally on drugs. At 6 o'clock in the morning, I would take 2 black mollies. At 10 o'clock, I would take 20 milligrams of Valium. At 11 o'clock, I'd have 3 martinis before lunch. At 2 o'clock, I'd take 20 milligrams of Valium. At 5 o'clock, I'd have 3 martinis before dinner. At 7 o'clock, I'd get down to serious drinking. At 11 o'clock, I'd have 200 milligrams of Seconal and another half a pint of vodka, and I'd sleep heavenly. You know, I could be anything you wanted me to be. Just tell me in time enough. And I knew how to work the dope, you know, to be anything you wanted me to be. You know, and I lived like that, ladies and gentlemen. If you would have called me and told me that I was living under the influence of drugs, I would have cursed you out, talked about your parents. Why? Because the doctor gave them to me. You know? How many of y'all have ever hidden behind the doctor? Come on now. Yeah. Yeah, you know, and it's strange. Let's just think about this. Now, think about this proposition. We doctors die 10 to 15 years younger than normal people, all right? We have heart attacks 10 times more than normal people. We have depression 17 times more than normal people. We have depression 12 times more than normal people. Thought disorder 5 times more than normal people. Alcoholism 5 times more than normal people. Drug dependency 20 times more than normal people. We commit suicide 50% more than normal people, but normal people come to us for advice. You know, there must be something wrong with normal people. Well, anyhow, I was in my dope for about 3 months, and one morning I woke up at the bottom of the ship, and there was white spit in my mouth, and I looked out the little hole, and I saw light coming in. I looked at my watch, and my watch said 6. Now, I didn't know if it was 6 in the morning or 6 in the evening, and time was very important, you know, because, you know, I'm a perfectionist, and I had lost 21 pounds by now. If it were 6 in the morning, I was supposed to have, you know, 40 milligrams of amphetamine. If it were 6 in the evening, I was supposed to have 3 martinis. So being a perfectionist, I just took all the dope for the day and washed it down with a half a pint of vodka, and I went and took convulsions, and they took me to the hospital, and they pumped me out, and they brought me back. I was swollen, and that same doctor that started me on the dope looked at me and came when I came back, and he said, boy, you know, you are a disgrace to the medical profession. You should surrender your license and go back to Oklahoma and teach school. That's about all you're good for anyhow. He said, but don't stop taking the drugs all of a sudden. He said, because you'll have withdrawal. He said, why don't you taper off? Why don't you take some of this methadone like these junkies take? He said, after all, you know it's not habit forming. The federal government gives it to them. You know? Yeah? And he said, now, Lewis, take 10 milligrams. Now, if you tell me to take 10 milligrams, how many will I have to take? 20, you know? And within 10 days, I had a $100-a-day methadone habit. And for some reason, I couldn't come back to Dallas hooked on methadone. So I kicked it by drinking a quart and a half of vodka a day. And ladies and gentlemen, drinking was no more fun after that. Drinking was medicine. I had to have it to be normal once I would start. I'm an episodic drunk. You know, I drank on episodes. I never got in trouble at work because when I drank, I never went to work, you know. I'm a spree drinker, you know. So, you know, my sprees run like this. See, I'm a very intelligent man. And so I knew how to cut down on my consumption of alcohol. You know, I started buying half a pint of vodka. So I'd go over and get a half a pint Rick's of vodka, you know, and I would stop by the drugstore and I would write a prescription in one of my kids' name and get 24 Seconal. And the drug company sent me all of the Valium that I could use in the mail. So my routine day would be, I would, you know, take a half a pint of vodka, take 70 milligrams of Valium. I would go to Church's Fried Chicken and get 2 wings, 1 roll, and 1 pepper. And I'd come home and eat the wings, the roll, and the pepper. And I would, you know, take 200 milligrams of Seconal and drink the other half a pint of vodka, and I'd pass out for 4 hours.
ladies and gentlemen.
And I would do that for 5 or 10 days until I'd start passing blood from both ends. I would go up to my office and get a bottle of Demerol, and I'd come home and I'd give myself Demerol shots until the bleeding would stop, and then I would start back to drinking again. And I would do that until I would get so sick that I'd have to go to a hospital and get dried out, you know. I can remember those mornings that I would be going across the bridge to get the liquor, and I could remember my thoughts, God, please let somebody come up the wrong way and hit me and kill me, and maybe they'll have some insurance that will be left for my wife and my children. Earlene kept telling me that I was an alcoholic, and I kept questioning her parentage, you know, and one day in August, she decided to take the kids home before school started, and I decided to show this lovely woman of God that I could get sober while she was gone. On day 3, I fell in the shower and I broke both of my shoulders. I had a concussion, you know. My blood sugar went up to over 500. My blood pressure went up to over 300, over 150. And I had kind of staggered out in the middle of the den, and I was almost to drown on my own vomitus when 2 of my gangster friends came by to get me to write them a hot prescription. And they saw me lying there almost to strangle on my own vomitus, and they kicked the door in and they took me to the hospital, you know, and they told me that I would die, or they told Earlene that I would die before morning. Matter of fact, the doctor wrote enough Valium for me to have that would kill me, and the nurse said, I refuse to give it to you. If you're going to die, just shake to death. Earlene was in Oklahoma and she came back, and you know, Earlene saw what a shape I was in, and the doctors told her that I was going to die, and she decided that my parents would probably blame her for it. See, because one time Earlene called my mother and said, Miss Dear, I think Tuffy's drinking too much. And my mother said, well, when he was with us, he didn't drink like that. You know, and you know, that just... she never called again, you know. And Earlene called suicide prevention before she decided to kill herself. And I'll always hate suicide prevention, you know, because they're the ones that convinced Earlene that I was an alcoholic and that she sure couldn't control it or help me, and that she needed to get her too many patients. I didn't have enough patients. The Dallas County Police, you know, and I had all these folks that I had blamed on my problems. But now my book is telling me that it's selfishness, me wanting things to go my way, self-centeredness, thinking that the whole world should evolve around what I wanted. Was my problem. And it was driven by 1,000 forms of fear and self-delusion and self-seeking, and how I wanted to be so good, but I'd step on everybody's toes and they would retaliate. But when they would retaliate, I couldn't see my fault. I could only see their fault. And again, I could project all of the blame on somebody else, you know. And he made me flip over to page 18, the doctor's opinion, you know. And the doctor gave me the answer to the problem. He said, I have this allergy of the body and an obsession of the mind. It's the obsession of the mind that tells me that I can one day drink just like everybody else. But when I take that drink, it kicks off the allergy, and I'm off and I'm running again. And the next morning, I wake up with that obsession. Yeah, the reason I drank last night and got drunk, I mixed that beer with that vodka. Today, I'll only drink Russian vodka, and that'll fix it. You know, I'll take 1 or 2 drinks, it kicks off the allergy, and I'm off and I'm running again. And ladies and gentlemen, I did that for 5 years, over and over and over. Sam made me turn to the chapter called There the Solution. Now, this was written by Dr. Jung, the second most famous psychiatrist in the world. And he said that my problem was I needed a spiritual experience. I needed to change my thinking, my feelings, and my action. And I said, well, Sam, I'm a doctor. Why do I need to change my thinking, my feelings, and my action? I was so humble at that time, you know. And Sam said, let's look at it. He said, Lewis, let's look at your actions. And I began to look at my actions. You know, I'm the kind of person that gets involved in 46 different things at the same time. Anybody like that? And guess how many I complete? 0. But guess what? I've got the indispensable part that the project cannot be completed without me. You know? You know, I love, you know, you could meet me in Dallas and you'd meet me on the freeway and I'd be driving 85 miles an hour. And you could pull me over and stop me and say, Lewis, where are you going? And I'd say, well, I don't know. you know? But I'm making damn good time. You know? How do y'all like that? I don't know where in the world I'm going, but boy, am I making good time getting there. Yeah? My feelings were out of balance. I only had two feelings, extreme love or what? Or extreme hate. Only had two kinds of people. I loved them and hate. Now, if I loved you, I had to do something for you. And if I hated you, I had to do something to you before I thought you did something to me. So I went through life, all of my life, ladies and gentlemen, I've been performing. You see, because if I have to do something for you, I can't be your friend. If I had to do something to you, you know I can't be your friend. So I perform with this group, I perform with that group, but nobody can walk down the aisle hand in hand with me. So that loneliness and that aloneness is bad. My thinking, ladies and gentlemen, I truly do believe in my heart that we are God's chosen people. I think we have the greatest brain or the greatest thought processes that's known. But I think our problem is not that we don't have a great mind, it's the direction of our mind, you know? My first self-help book I read was Your Erroneous Zones by the Baldhead Dude. You know, and he tells a story that's perfect for what I think is an alcoholic mind. He states that this famous speaker was going to make a speech one night, and he stepped up to the podium, and he just reached up and he set a glass of 100-proof Russian vodka on the stand. He reached in his inside pocket and he pulled out an earthworm, which is similar to the lining of our bodies, and he dropped the earthworm in the glass of vodka. You know, and the earthworm, you know, swam a semicircle and it just evaporated. And he stepped back and he said, "What does that teach you about alcohol?" A normal person sitting on the front row stood up, adjusted his tie, cleared his throat, got the speaker's attention, and he said, "Sir, what that teaches us is that if you drink strong liquor over a long period of time, it will cause a deterioration of the connective tissue lining of the alimentary canal, therefore predisposing you for ulcers, gastritis, duodenitis, and various other types of illnesses." A drunk in the back of the room said, "That's a lie. That's a damn lie. What that teaches you is if you drink plenty of good vodka, you'll never have worms." You know? You know? And you know, ladies and gentlemen, it is true. Now, you won't have a stomach, but you won't have worms. But isn't it wonderful how we alcoholics and drug addicts can take just a little drop of the truth, and we can twist it and turn it, and it's 99.9% of the truth. So he said, "Lewis, you keep with that kind of thinking, and it causes you to lose this peace of mind, or this homeostasis, as we doctors call it. And you know, you're an animal, and all animals must have peace of mind." And he said, "And you knew back when you went to the senior prom, if you take a drink, you could get that peace of mind back." And he said, "And you pick up that first drink, and it sets off that craving, and you're off and you're running again." He said, "Lewis, so what we need to do, we need to change the thinking, your feelings, and your actions." And I said, "Well, how do you change your thinking, your feelings, and your actions?" And he said, "Wonderful. Alcoholics Anonymous has given us 12 steps in order to change your thinking, your feelings, and your actions." He said, "Step one," he said, "Lewis, we're going to have to get you to divide these steps up." He said, "These steps are so simple, and you've been to school 15 years, you know, and you're so stupid, you know, because you've been trained far beyond your ability to comprehend." He said, "So we're going to have to divide the steps up for you." He said, "So he made me divide step one into two parts. Part one is we admitted we were powerless over alcohol. Now, my sponsor made me take each word in the step and break it down." He said, "Lewis, why do you think they put we first?" And I said, "Well, I gave one of those long definitions." He said, "No." He said, "Basically what they did so they'd know who we were talking about. See, I blamed all my problems on Earlene. So he made me take we out and I had to put I." And he said, "What does it mean?" I gave him a long definition. He said that, you know, were that I was powerless. He said, "Lewis, powerless is a big word. Take it out and put another one in." He made me put control over alcohol. And now he made me read the step was, I said that I had lost control over alcohol. He said, "Lewis, can you admit that?" I said, "Yes." You know, didn't have to say I was a drunk or do anything. In order to take the first half of the first step, all I had to do was say that when I pour that brown liquid in my mouth, I cannot control it as much as I will pour in the way in which I'll act once it gets in there. He said, now the second half is that our, he said, that means your, my life. He said, what's life? And I gave him a long definition. He said, but basically it's what you think, the way you feel, and how you act. Had become unmanageable. That's a big word for you, boy. He said, you better take that one out. And he said, what can you put in? I said, uncontrollable. Now I've got to say that my thinking, feelings, and action had become uncontrollable. Sounds simple. It took me 5 years to take this step, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, I took it, you know, in meetings. Somebody said, my name is Greg and I'm an alcoholic, and I'd be sitting next to him. I'd say, my name is Lewis, I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict, see. I'd go around and somebody say, my name is Greg, I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict. I said, my name is Lewis, I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict, and I've got depression. See, I don't let anybody beat me doing anything, you know. You don't beat me doing anything, you know. But deep down in my heart, I knew that I really wasn't an alcoholic, see. And I knew that one day that I would be able to drink just like normal people would, you know. But that morning, I decided to kill myself after 5 years of sobriety. And I started talking with Sam. My life began to change. You know, I had to say in my closet to myself, by myself, that I can't even control pouring a brown liquid in my mouth with 15 years of college. But not only that, I can't even control what I think, the way I feel, and how I act. And you want me to do that. You know, ladies and gentlemen, that is the most humiliating thing that I've ever done. You know, hell, this is unpatriotic. You know, have y'all ever thought about step one? I'm an American, you know. When I was getting out of high school, they said, it don't matter if you're black, you can be anything you want to be. Hit your wagon to a star. Pull yourself up by your own bootstrap. Ladies and gentlemen, I started off in life shining shoes. And at 28 years of age, I was a physician and surgeon. I had all this power, you know. They told me, you can do it, dear. You're all right, man. You know, and then I come to you freaks, and y'all tell me, turn it over. It's un-American. You know, I'm an American. Hell, we'd drop bombs on your ass if you don't do what we tell you to do. You know? Yes, that's no ego. We don't play that shit. But now, and I want y'all, and y'all telling me to do all of this crap, you know, and be a good Christian shit. You know, and it's just sickening to me. You know? And then after that, it took me 5 years to do step one. And I felt so vulnerable. People say they got relief. I felt vulnerable, ladies and gentlemen, you know. Because that was the first time in my life I admitted to myself that I couldn't handle something. Ladies and gentlemen, step one is my bottom. I think that a bottom, it doesn't matter whether you're in the penthouse or the poorhouse, when you can admit to yourself that you cannot control pouring a brown liquid in your mouth, but not only that, you can't control what you think, feel, and act. Ladies and gentlemen, you have admitted. Then they had me come along and say, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. That's not the most stupid thing I've ever heard in my life, you know? Don't start sentences with came. You know, who wrote this shit anyhow, you know? Y'all ever thought about it? You don't start sentences. You know, this is grammatically incorrect. You know, I'm an assistant professor of psychiatry at Southwestern Medical School in Dallas. And they all know I'm an alcoholic, so I'd go out there and they'd say, hey, doctor, we understand you're sober. I said, yes. He said, how long have you been sober off of alcohol? I said, 15 years. And they said, well, how are you doing it, doctor? I said, well, I'm just coming to believe that a power greater than myself. You know, you don't do that, you know. So my sponsor made me break this step down into three parts, you know. First of all, he made me break it down and came to believe, you know. And then, by the way, Al-Anon told me that this is some kind of sentence that's dangling somewhere, and I had to put a we on there. And when you put the we on it, it makes a little more sense. But he made me break it down into three sentences, came to believe. You see, my belief system, which was so negative, is what caused me to lose my peace of mind, which caused me to pick up the drink in the first place, ladies and gentlemen. You see, I have this negative belief system. You walk up and give me $100, and I'll say, what do I have to do for it? Lewis, your mom, that bullshit, you know? You know, I just don't believe anything, you know? You know, my beliefs, I'm kind of like the little Canadian boy that would go out in the woods and play every day, and every day he'd get lost. One day when he came in, his mother said, son, the next time you go out in the woods and play and you get lost, Get out on your knees, pray to God, and ask God to show you the way out. So the next day, the little boy went out, and sure enough, he got lost. And he got down on his knees and said, "Oh, Heavenly Father, I'm lost." And he stuck his hand out and closed his eyes. "Please lead." And by the time he said lead, a bird came by and did number two in his hand, you know. And so he shook it out, and he washed his hand off, and he got back down on his knees. I think the boy was an alcoholic, because he said, "Oh, Heavenly Father, great creator of the heavens and earth, I am in need of your help." He said, "Oh, Heavenly Father," and he stuck his hand out. He said, "Hey, man, I'm lost. Don't hand me no shit." You know, and that's how my life is. I think that everybody was trying to hand me some shit. You know, but now they're telling me I had to came to believe. Came is a verb. You don't start sentences with verb. But the reason the sponsor said they did it, verb is a form of speech that means action. You know, I wanted 10 years of AA, my second AA meeting. So they're telling me that, "Lewis, you can't get it through osmosis. You got to take some action to change your negative thinking to positive." And the first action you have to take is to believe that a power greater than yourself. Immediately, I thought of God, you know. Now, I couldn't pay a $200 a month house note with 15 years of college, but the only power greater than me was God. Now, my sponsor said, "Lewis, let me tell you how to find a power greater than yourself. Take 10 men out in the woods and line them up and increase in strength and go down the line and slap each one. The one that slaps back harder than you slapped him, boy, that's the power greater than you." You know, and I understood that then, you know. I understood it. Could restore us to sanity. I'm so grateful to God this morning that they put "could restore me to sanity instead of "would restore me to sanity." Because you see, I am so defiant. If you tell me something will work, I'll prove and I'll work and show you that it won't. If you tell me something might, could work, if you help, I'll prove and show you that it will. Ladies and gentlemen, I've never smoked a cigarette, never had a desire to smoke a cigarette. I've only wanted to smoke a cigarette twice in my life. The first time was November the 17th, 1986. What was going on then? Right, the day of the great American smokeout, you know? You know, everybody on TV, radio, loudspeakers were saying what? Don't smoke. I wanted to smoke that day. You know, and the second time, by mistake, early and I stayed in a non-smokers hotel in Houston, Texas, and I was walking up and down the hall looking for a cigarette, you know. And the second time is, could restore us to sanity. I thought sanity meant in crazy, but sanity means balance. And balance of what, Lewis? I lost my balance in my thinking, feelings, and action in step one. And they're telling me if I could get out of myself and trust somebody else, I might have the ability to get balance back in my thinking, feelings, and action in step two. Step three, it says, made a decision. I got to get off the pot now. And I got to turn off the talking. And I've got to say, I'm going to turn my will, my thinking, and my life, the results of my action, over to the care of God as I understood God. My understanding of God was given to me my grandmother when I was 6 and she was 60. She told me God was a man sitting on a cloud with 2 blackboards. He made a mark on one when I did good and a mark on another when I did bad. And if I had more good marks than bad marks in the end, I would go to this place called heaven. And I'd roll around on golden streets and I'd drink milk and honey all day. The only problem was I had to give up everything that was fun in order to get there, including that thing that was guaranteed to drive me blind prior to being 14. You know, I didn't understand that. And you know, like I tell you, when I started, I've never had to work, never had to do anything. You know, and I didn't understand why you want to go to heaven. Everybody that's got on a gold ring, feel that gold ring. You know, feel it right now, quick. You know, how does it feel? It's what? It's hard. Now, who in the hell would want to roll around on golden streets all day? You know, 87% of all black people are allergic to milk, and I'm allergic to milk, so I can't drink milk, you know, and I'm a diabetic, and I can't eat sweets. So I had no reason to want to go to this place Mama called heaven. And then Mama laid it on me. She said, "Boy, if you don't make heaven," she said, "you will be put in hell. And in hell, there's an eternal fire, and you'll burn. And your screams will be heard throughout eternity. And if you get too done on one side," Mama said, "there would be a dude down there with a pitchfork to jug you in the gluteus maximus and flip you over." I don't know how they could tell on me, you know, but, you know, And being an humble little Christian, I said, Mama, why does God want to do me like that? And Mama said, because he loves you, my son, because he loves you. You know, I'm so grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous, because when I finally got here, I hated God. I used to go down to the prisons, and I made a speech one day, and after I got through, a priest stood up and talked. And this priest said, 90% of the people that come to me are confused about God. He said they all want a Baptist understanding, a Methodist, a Catholic, a Jewish understanding of God. He said, but in actual reality, the only understanding of God that you can have is what? The one that you have. You see, my problem, I've always known and loved God. God to me is love, period. You know? But you see, God was being loved was cool when I was in Sunday school. But at 13, I had to start going to church with Mama. And I've always been kind of slick. I'd put a quarter in the collection plate and take out change for 50 cents. And Mama would slap me on the hand and she'd say, boy, God's going to get you for that. And I'd drop my quarter on the floor and I would get down to pick it up and I'd look up one of the sister's dresses. And Mama would slap me on the head and say, God's going to get you for that. You know, and all the things that I wanted to do at 14, God was going to get me for it. You know, and I developed a hate for God. And on page 46 in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, it tells me that I can have any concept of God that I want just so long as I don't think that I'm God. And that's where AA will let me start. You know, ladies and gentlemen, life don't get too much better than this. I'm supposed to tell how it is today. You know, ladies and gentlemen, it is humanly impossible to get from where I was in 1975 to where I am today. You know, in 1975, I told you about my drinking, but I didn't tell you that in 1975, they also had me in court. They said I was part of a plot to tie old people up in a chair, give them Valium, whip them, and take their Social Security checks. You know, and they sued me in the 105th District Court trying to take away my license. Well, in 1986, I was appointed the court psychiatrist for the 106th District Court, you know? And you just can't get there humanly from where I was. And, you know, and it's not about me, ladies and gentlemen. I've been doing the same thing. The only thing I do is wake up, suit up, and show up. And I get out of the way and let life go on for me. How are things today? I don't know. I still have fear, but you know, I confront my fear today. I try to confront it, and I try to be open, and I try to be honest. You know, resentment, I still have resentments. You know, 2 years ago we had a mammoth school reunion and they asked me to make the banquet speech, and about halfway through my speech, you remember Linward? Yeah, Linward walked in, you know. And I still hate that son of a bitch, you know. Yeah. Sex, still have a problem with sex. But you know, ladies and gentlemen, I want y'all to take a serious sex inventory tonight. And I want you to tell me how much did you do versus how much you thought about doing. Yeah? You know, I found out all my sex problem was in my head. You know, it's not the sex deal, it's the guilt that I had from it is one problem. It kind of reminds me of my friend, you know. He tells a story of the mouse that went to the circus looking for the new fine elephant to take her care of her. And he said he followed and he just worried this elephant out of a little favor that night. And they went to the motel, and I mean, and the mouse got down with the elephant and took the elephant through every position in the summa cum laude. The mouse just really got it on. During the middle of the performance, the elephant gave the mouse a standing ovation. I mean, the mouse performed, you know. And they woke up the next day, and the mouse, you know how we have that grin on our face when you think we've done something the night before? And the mouse wanted the elephant to congratulate him for his action. And he looked over at the elephant, and the elephant was lying on his back with his feet sticking straight up in the air, just as stiff and just stone dead. The mouse said, well, I'll just be damned. One night of pleasure, and I've got to spend the rest of my life digging a hole to bury it in. You know? You know? I hear that's how we are with guilt, ladies and gentlemen. We don't do that much. You know, if I think about doing something once, I'm kind of, you know, funny. If I think about it twice, I might even call and apologize. You know, never do anything, ladies and gentlemen. How are things on the inside today? Outside, you just can't imagine how good it is for me and my wife and my family. But how are things on the inside? I never like to close one of these things unless I say this. Ladies and gentlemen, God has been so good to me. God, we have money, we have houses, and we have all this outside crap. You know, and we fly places and we go places, and, you know, we want lobster one night and we'll go somewhere and get it, you know. But ladies and gentlemen, somehow if you haven't had that, don't worry about it too much. It's really not that big a deal, and you really haven't missed that much. But somehow, if you've lived in this life, and you have the problems that we alcoholics and drug addicts have, and you miss Alcoholics Anonymous, and you miss Al-Anon, Al-Ateen, Al-Ajet, Al-Adol, you miss the working through of a problem with another human being. Ladies and gentlemen, you've missed a lot. But if somehow you can live in this life, and you miss the power, the grace, the kindness of a kind and loving God that I found right here in Alcoholics Anonymous, you've missed it all. You know, ladies and gentlemen, I went from where I was in 1975. I have four jobs today to where I am today by three basic things. You know, first of all, I had to trust God, clean house, and do my best to help my fellow man. You know, I've been sober about 15 years, ladies and gentlemen, and I'm on a 3-year cycle. You know, I do the steps somewhere every month. In Dallas, we have somebody come in and talk about the steps, you know, every month. And I've been doing that for the last 3 years. And about every 3 years, I began to read my clippings and began to think how wonderful I am. And I began to withdraw from AA so y'all can't see how human I really am. And I began to get lonely and alone. And I began to ride in my car and I turn off the radio so I can hear myself think I get to be so important. And all of a sudden, I start shying away from AA. But I'm so grateful that every time there's always somebody that will ask me to do something and pull me back in. But you know the most powerful thing, ladies and gentlemen, that I know in my heart, that if some way that I don't get pulled back and that I have to go back out and I have to drink again and I have to do some of those terrible things that I used to do and I have to hurt and I have to pain and I have to lose all these physical things and I have to lose this family and I have to lose everything that I've ever had, you know, I'll get enough courage and I'll walk back through these doors, and I know all of y'all will still be here and you'll have that smile on your face, and when I walk in, you won't look the other way. You'll look me in the eye. You'll shake my hand. And you'll say, "Welcome, Lewis. Glad to have you." And I'll be back home. Thank you so much, and I love you.